From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Stocks dropped again this morning despite President Trump's blink yesterday, his announcement that he'd delay new tariffs on some Chinese imports until December. The White House has been under pressure from businesses worried about how the escalating trade dispute between China and the U.S. will impact the economy.
Also in Washington, Democrats want the Republican-controlled Senate to cut short its recess to vote on new gun legislation in the wake of those two mass shootings earlier this month. Let's bring in our political strategist, Alice Stewart, Republican strategist. Hi, Alice.
Hi, Jeremy. Great to be here.
And Bill Press, Democratic strategist. Hi, Bill.
Hey, guys. Hi. Robin and Jeremy. Good to be with you.
Well, and let's start with what's going on with the economy. And I'm going to hold off on getting into the back and forth about the tariffs and the Christmas shopping season and all that, because we are going to touch on that elsewhere in the program. But Alice, as you see the stock market drop and be very volatile at the very least right now, how important is the strength of the economy to the president's reelection effort?
Critical. Of utmost importance, Jeremy. And this is one of his strong suits. This is something that he has taken credit for quite some time, and it is instrumental for him to have a strong economy. But I do caution everyone who has the Democrats and some of those who are lighting their hair on fire to look at this more from a long-term perspective. The market has been up and down lately, but we need to make sure and look at it from the long ball perspective and not jump to conclusions. You know, there are certainly some areas of concern. I am concerned about the tariffs that we'll talk about, but we need to not jump to conclusions and let this ride and see where we are in a few months from now.
Bill, how do you see this? And how do you think the Democrats ought to deal with this? We remember when President Obama was in power, he was very careful not to say that the economy was doing great because there were a lot of people for whom it was not doing great. But President Trump has been very vocal in saying this is, you know, the best economy that we've ever seen in this country.
Well, certainly the market has had some ups and downs, but I think it's safe to say that the American economy is still strong. The economic recovery started under Barack Obama for 8 years. It's continued under Donald Trump. I think I've said on this program before, I think Donald Trump is making a mistake. I think he ought to talk more about the economy and about how it has remained strong. There are some undersides, and that's what Democrats have to talk about in terms of wages, particularly in terms of the middle class not benefiting as well as the wealthy are. But overall, I think the president has a strong case to make. And instead, he spends all of his time on this silly stuff, like, you know, attacking members of Congress or whatever.
Well, funny you should mention.
All of his daily tweets.
Funny you should mention, because let's talk about tone. And President Trump gave a speech on energy last night at a Shell petrochemicals plant. It was, you know, being built outside Pittsburgh. This is what he talked about. Let's listen.
Can you imagine if I got a fair press? I mean, we're leading without it. Can you imagine if these people treated me fairly? The election would be over. Have they ever called off an election before? Just said, look, just let's go. Go on. 4 more years.
And Bill, I want you to pick up first, then Alice. This is, I think, to your point that he's not talking about the economy. However, this is a president who has cast himself as the victim of both the press and people like Anthony Scaramucci, who is coming out and full-blooded saying to other Republicans, President Trump is off the rails and should be replaced. Isn't this maybe a successful means for him to cast himself this way because his passionate backers believe this?
Well, first of all, it's just totally fraudulent for him to say that he's been mistreated by the press. He would, by the media.
I didn't say
in general,
it was true.
I understand. I didn't mean to jump on you, Robin, at all. I said it's fraudulent for him to say that because he is the beneficiary of being on the media for 14 years under The Apprentice. During the campaign, as we know, when they clocked how much airtime the candidates got, Donald Trump got far more time than anybody else. Basically, Jeff Zucker from CNN made Donald Trump president of the United States. So his complaints, I think, just ring hollow on that score. But again, in Pittsburgh, when he's supposed to give a speech on energy, that's all he talks about. When he goes to El Paso, for God's sake, where he's supposed to be the condoler in chief, if that's the word, he talks about his crowds and his campaigns and how well he would do carrying Texas in the next time.
Well, and Alice, this is what led to the blow up with Anthony Scaramucci, who said enough is enough. It was the visits to Dayton and El Paso that he says, Anthony Scaramucci, the former communications director, says pushed him over the edge and brought his criticism of Trump. Is this Trump making a mistake or being, you know, smart like a fox?
I think this is Trump being Trump. Mm. And this is what we had during the campaign. This is what we've had during the White House. And it won't change. He will continue to pick these fights that, in his mind, energize his base and keeps them engaged. At the same time, I anticipate, as we continue down the campaign trail, tomorrow he'll be speaking in New Hampshire. He will be talking about the economy. He'll be talking about the new jobs that have been added in the Granite State.
Want
to
bet?
Unemployment rate.
Want to bet?
The unemployment. The problem is he does talk about these things, but they get overshadowed by sideshows, whether they're self-inflicted or the media wants to do that. He does talk about, everywhere he goes on these campaign rallies, he talks about how the economy is strong in these particular areas, but that often gets overshadowed by the press or himself.
Well, and for example, in Pittsburgh, I just have to add, he talked about Hillary Clinton again. And of course, they started chanting, lock her up. Now, that's self-inflicted. Alex, you can't blame that on the media. That's Donald Trump. He just cannot control himself.
Let's talk about a big issue that's very important right now with the two of you, and that is gun control and whether there's going to be some action in Congress on that after these two shootings. Here's Representative Steny Hoyer, Democrat, speaking to reporters yesterday.
I've been in politics for a long time. It takes no courage to put on the Senate floor a bill that is supported by 90%+ of Americans. What takes courage is to look a special interest group in the eye and say, enough is enough. It is time to act.
Alice, is there going to be action on gun control?
Without a doubt. We can't stand on the sidelines and not do anything. But it's important that we not just do it right now, but we have to do it right. And he was correct. 9 in 10 Americans do support a type of stricter background checks. 6 in 10 do support assault weapons ban. But when you further the conversation and peel back the layers, you have to take into consideration people like myself that are NRA members, gun owners, strong supporters of the Second Amendment. And when we have these conversations, that we protect Second Amendment rights. And whether we're talking background checks or bans or what I think will ultimately pass the red flag laws, we have to make sure we have due process protections in place. And if someone is deemed a threat, that they do get the mental health treatment that they need. So this needs to be considered.
Bill, do you think that those things are going to pass? And I've already heard that Senator Barrasso, who's in the leadership on the Republican side, is coming out with some problems he has with the red flag laws.
I salute Alice for recognizing that there are several common sense gun safety measures that can and should be enacted that would preserve people's Second Amendment rights. But I do not join her in her optimism that anything is going to happen. I hate to say it. I've basically given up because we have – look, the American people are there. Our political leadership, particularly the Republican leadership, Donald Trump, Mitch McConnell, are not there. They are owned by the NRA. All this talk about something might happen, give me a break. We've heard it so many times before. We are the mass murder capital of the world. I think it's a national disgrace that we don't do something about it.
With all due respect, it's completely inaccurate to say nothing has been done. Unfortunately, it does take something for action to happen. After Las Vegas, they took action on bump stocks. After Parkland, they addressed the fixed NICS system, which was to correct the notification system. So they have done something. Unfortunately, we don't need another tragedy for action.
But those are such baby steps, Alice. No background, nothing on background checks, nothing on the red flag law, nothing on the assault weapons ban.
Alice, you said bans in passing. Should assault weapons be banned?
We need to take a closer look. We need to have that conversation.
But
we
need to see?
Robin, here's what's important. AR-15s are the most popular rifle in this country. Living in Arkansas for many years, many people have them in their homes for their self-protection. That is listed as an assault rifle. That needs to be in my view, taken out of the ban. We don't need to take a weapon that is popular and useful and used for safety out of the hands of law-abiding gun owners. And that's the critical component.
I just have to add, I don't care if it's popular or not. I think that's a totally irrelevant question. The issue is, how many people can it kill by pulling that trigger? And it's about 30 or 40 maybe. And nobody needs an assault weapon or an AR-15.
And that's when we're talking about a weapon that's been retrofitted with a high-capacity magazine. And yes, those high-capacity magazines, I'm in favor of banning those. Adam Kinzinger has discussed that. So there are options that need to be on the table, but we need to make sure we look at the details of these proposals and, as I say, not infringe on Second Amendment rights.
So Mitch McConnell, bring him back and let's have that discussion. He won't, because he's owned by the NRA.
Well, I was going to say, Mitch McConnell, if you're listening, Alice Stewart and Bill Press have weighed in. Alice Stewart, the Republican strategist, Bill Press, the Democrat. It's the conversation that we hope to hear more of. Alice, Bill, thank you so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Thank you, guys. Thank you.
Oh, the impossibly beautiful voice of Vince Gill. I Still Believe in You. Country music superstar Vince Gill's first number one hit back in 1992. He co-wrote it with John Varlow Jarvis, and he's had many more. He's won 21 Grammys, sold over 26 million albums, was inducted in Country Music's Hall of Fame in 2007. He's had stints with the Eagles and early on with Pure Prairie League. So why is he so humble? Well, it could be his respect for fellow greats Merle Haggard, Guy Clark. It could be the influence of his wife, Amy Grant, or his mom. He sings about all of them on his new deeply personal album. Here's a little of A Letter to My Mama.
I'm sorry I was selfish. Let's chalk it up to you. I got too old to need you. That's just running from the truth. I'm sorry things didn't work out. Sometimes life don't turn out like you plan.
Oh, I am not going to get through this interview. Vince Gill's new album is Okie, what used to be a derogatory word to people from his state. He's taken that word back. He joins us from Nashville. Vince Gill, did you shed tears when you wrote that song?
Well, sure. How can you not when you're singing about your mom?
No. Well, there's tears listening to it.
Yeah, she's 93. She's 93 years old, still around, and I thought she deserved a song. This song is really old. It's about 18 years old, and rediscovered it in a desk drawer and thought, oh, this might fit this new record.
Well, it's beautiful. And the whole album feels so personal. What's going on?
Well, I think it's just a reflection of a lot of life lived. It's time to be a little bit reflective and maybe talk about the perspective of a life with this many years attached to it.
In fact, I think I read that a friend of yours sent you an email saying you could only have written this after 60 years.
Yeah, I think so.
He was referring, I think, to one of the songs that has, you know, there's social issues addressed on this album. There's one song, What Choice Will You Make? Teenagers in a Car Who Went Too Far.
Yeah, about a teenage pregnancy. And what's beautiful about this song is it doesn't judge. It doesn't say what you should or shouldn't do. And it never really leaves that moment either, which I think is really neat about the song.
What choice will you make? Whose heart will you break? What is
There's another song that's just so powerful, Forever Changed, and you're speaking directly to sexual abusers. Let's listen.
You put your hands where they don't belong. And now her innocence is dead and gone. She feels dirty, she feels ashamed. Because of you, she's forever changed.
Okay. Did you cry during this one?
Well, yeah.
Yeah.
I always joke that my granny used to say, if your eyes leak, your head won't swell. You know, so.
But where did this come from?
Just empathy for people that have been acted upon. When I was a young kid, I was seventh grade and playing on the basketball team at school. And the basketball coach tried to act on me. And in seventh grade, nobody knows anything about what the heck's going on. And here's somebody you look up to and you think is, mm-hmm. you know, the greatest thing in the whole world. And I just jumped up and ran. As he mm-hmm. put his hand further up my leg, I just said, there's something wrong here. And I ran. And so I was lucky. You know, I did not get abused, but I sure could have been. And I think it gave me perhaps a place to come from in maybe the telling of a story like this.
Well, it is going to give a lot of people the permission to tell their story, what you just said.
I hope so.
Yeah.
Some people can suppress and be okay. You mm-hmm. know, some people can't. It's not one way. So if there's somebody that's kind of a voice for them and sticking up for them and being kind to them, you know, mm-hmm. I think it goes a long way.
Well, then there's your faith, which seems to pale, at least in some of these songs here, next to your wife, Amy's. And I want to say to you...
It does.
It does. But you know what, Vince Gill? Many things pale next to Amy Grant, so don't take it personally. But you write about the red words in the Bible. You know, these are the words that Jesus, you know, is thought to have spoken in there. You know, everybody who has an old childhood Bible, even
sure.
those red words. But also the song, When My Amy Prays. Let's just listen to a little.
All my life I've known of Jesus, but that connection never came. And when my world was torn to pieces, I still couldn't call his name. When my Amy prays, when my Amy prays, that's when I see his face.
So your head was leaking during this, we know. Whoa. What is that like? I mean, we hear what it's like to watch her. Amy Grant, Christian singer.
Yeah, well, she's easily the most welcoming, non-judgmental, kindest soul I've ever come across.
And all I ever have to be is what you've made me. Any more or less would be a step out of your plan. As you daily recreate me, help me always keep in mind that I only have to do what I can find.
It's remarkable to watch her just kind of react to life and the people in it and when they come into your life and how she treats them, you know. In that other song, The Red Words, it's a comparison of her. She reminds me of those red words because of the non-judgment and the welcoming of all people, all races, all sexualities, all things, you know, sometimes that world of evangelicals can't embrace, she does. And it's beautiful to stand behind her and watch it.
She's her best in conversation. I've never seen her turn away. An open invitation, just like the Bible's red words say.
We just want to mention some of the other people who've inspired you who are also on the album. Merle Haggard, who of course had his own Okie song, Okie from Muskogee. Guy Clark, we recently spoke to Steve Earle about his dear friend Guy Clark who passed. Do you know that people think of you in the same firmament, or would that offend you? Or,
Well, no. I mean, I don't think I'd ever, with a straight face, feel like I've achieved their level of greatness, you know. And it's unfortunate that so many of my heroes are passing on. And you know, maybe when they're all gone, I might finally welcome that role of the elder statesman. And I do anyway, you know, with young kids that I've had an impact on them and wanting to learn to play and sing and write songs and stuff. So I get it. But, you know, I just have such a tremendous reverence for my heroes. Like in the songs about Guy and about Merle, just trying to, I try to grieve a lot of times through songs, you know, in losing people that I love. And we're talking earlier about people that are abused. It's hurt. It hurts you. So, yeah, some of that's coming from a grieving kind of place and trying to tell stories about, you know, what moves me. Music has always, to me, been about being moved more than being impressed. In the way that I try to write and play and sing, I want a listener to be moved much more than I want them to be impressed.
Well, we now have the answer to the question we posed at the beginning, which is why you are so humble, why you don't have a swelled head, because you're leaking all the time. And so are we. What a beautiful new album. It's called Okie. It's from Vince Gill. Thank you so much for talking to us about it.
What a treat. Thank you so much. Come and put
your arms around me. So we're giving you a heads up. The album comes August 23rd. Till then, you can listen to this story again and again. In my hands.
Let them the stock market opened sharply down this morning, despite President Trump saying yesterday that he's postponing the tariffs on some items until after the Christmas shopping season. Popular items like cell phones, laptops, and toys won't see that 10% tariff that Trump announced at the beginning of this month until after December 15th. Best Buy and Apple, which get many of their products from China, saw their stocks surge yesterday, but stocks not looking good today. Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent, joins us now. Hi, Ali.
Hey, Jeremy.
Now, President Trump has always maintained that China's the one paying for the tariffs,
right,
not Americans. And yesterday he said he's, quote, doing this for the Christmas season, just in case some of the tariffs would have an impact on U.S. consumers. So is this Trump basically admitting that tariffs are paid for by Americans?
Yeah, and a number of groups have done studies on the prices of goods that are imported versus the prices of goods that are not imported. And there has been a spike in the prices of imported goods. In some cases, major corporations can hold those price increases off for a while in the hopes that this will get settled and they don't lose customers. But obviously, around Christmas time, everybody is hyper price sensitive. Phones and electronics and things like that really sell. So if you were to see a 10% tariff, it's not clear that all 10% would immediately go to the consumer, but you'd see a price increase. This is something everybody has been saying for a long time. The president continues to deny. But yes, yesterday was finally a concession that, okay, this actually might be a problem. And you also don't want to slow down sales, not just to make things more expensive, but if you increase prices, people slow down their spending. That, in a slightly weak economy, could send us into a bit of a downturn. Christmas before an election year is probably not the kind of thing a president wants to do.
Right. But does China look at this and say, oh, look at that, we won, they backed down first?
Yeah, and look, this is for a lot of reasons, this is a really complicated week for China, and China's under a lot of pressure because of what's going on in Hong Kong. You might almost think this wasn't a week for the president to do this, given that China's facing it on all fronts. But for the moment, this is a minor victory for China. I say that only because the imposition of the tariffs would have been very damaging to China. It is worth saying that while the U.S. consumers are paying for the tariffs, China is hurting because of this trade war. Everybody's hurting. This is what one economist described to me yesterday as a lose-lose situation.
Now, if yesterday was the day that America got a Christmas present from the Trump administration, according to the White House, maybe today was the day that they returned the sale took everything back. Is this just fears about a recession? We've been talking about the yield curve, which is a recession indicator that seems to be pointing to another one now. What do you think?
Yeah, and so the yield curve means what's the difference between you putting your money in the the bank and saying that you'll keep it there for 2 years versus you'll keep it there for 10 years. Mm-hmm. Historically, the bank would say, if you give us your money for 10 years, we can do more with it. We'll pay you a higher interest rate. So the yield curve was always the difference between short-term interest rates and long-term interest rates. Today, they crossed. Today, you get more money for investing your money for a short term mm-hmm. than you do for a long term. Now, it's not a direct relationship to a recession. It tends to be an indicator that one is coming in about 2 years or 18 months to 2 years. That's what's got the markets worried today. Short-term rates, very, very good, by the way, for a borrower. Short-term rates are very low right now. Long-term rates are higher, but that is what the problem is. The yield curve suggests that the economy is weakening.
Well, and as you said, President Trump does not want that to happen before the election.
Right.
But, of course, presidents cannot stop recessions from happening. Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent, thank you.
My pleasure, Jeremy.
Many of you might have heard of or hiked the fabled Inca Trail, that 27-mile trek through Peru's sacred valley, ending at the ruins of Machu Picchu. The trail has some basic amenities, a lot of tourists. Then there's the Salkantay Trail to Machu Picchu, nearly 40 miles long with dramatic mountain ranges, including a 15,157-foot pass, most hikers covered in about 4 days and three nights. But Tyler Andrews is not your average hiker. He is the second fastest American to run 50 kilometers. He's also set the world record for the fastest treadmill half marathon. We spoke to him at that time. And he's preparing for his second Olympic marathon trial. And now he's recorded the fastest known time ever. That's the FKT on Peru's Salkantay Trail, a mind-boggling 6 hours, 13 minutes, and 3 seconds. Here's a moment from his GoPro cam during that run.
Wow! Oh my God. And now we start a long, long downhill.
Now I start a long, long downhill. Tyler Andrews, who's sponsored by the Hoka Ona Ona Athletic Company, is back at sea level in our Here and Now studios. He actually ran here. Tyler, I walked the Inca Trail, and when I'm at 12,000 feet, I get altitude sickness and slow down. You ran the Salkantay Trail at 15,000 feet. How?
Part of it is practice and just getting used to it. For me, one of the things that was so attractive about running this particular trail was how familiar I was with it. I've probably hiked it 5 or 10 times in the last decade through my work with Strive, which is a youth program for athletes that I run during the summers. And trail running is always something that's been super appealing to me. I love the mountains. I love running. I love pushing myself. I perform really well at altitude. And so this was kind of the coming together of all those things for me.
Yeah. But still, running this whole thing, I mean, what does it feel like?
It's a lot to take in at once. So one of the things that I did was try to really segment it in my mind. I kind of knew, okay, this is where we usually stop. This is where the campsites are. This is where the high passes are. These are the most challenging sections of the route. So I was able to really not think about it all as one big thing, but more as a whole bunch of little things mm-hmm. that were strung together.
Are you in your head or are you seeing? What are you seeing?
I mean, I'm just seeing the mountains. I try to write a mantra on my arm before a big effort like this. And the one that I wrote before this run was savor every moment. I knew that I was going to go through patches where it felt really uncomfortable or I was feeling sorry for myself. And I really just wanted to take those moments and redirect them.
The extremes in temperature, what might they be?
It was crazy. I've never experienced anything like that in a single race or anything. I mean, it was probably 20 Fahrenheit in the morning when I left the camp at dawn.
Oh, freezing.
-7, yeah, below freezing. And then once the sun comes out, it warms up really quick. Plus, you're going way down in altitude, so it gets much warmer. It's probably in the 80s, in the 90s even, wow. In the sun.
Wow.
Yeah.
I'm assuming you had support team?
So no, actually, one of the in terms of the way they do fastest known time records, FKTs, there's a category for supported and unsupported. And I did the entire run, what they call unsupported, which means you carry everything you need for the entire run.
How did you feel when you finished it at 6 hours? I mean, you knew that you'd had the fastest known time.
It was a really special moment because this was one of the harder things that I've ever done. When I finished, I was lucky enough to have my close friend and training partner there, but really it was this moment where my body is in all this discomfort and I'm feeling a lot of pain, but just so happy with what I had done, really loving just where I was in this place at that moment.
And then the award ceremony. No. nothing.
Yeah, exactly. There's no finisher's medal. There's no, you know, race t-shirt. There's nothing like that. The FKT world is kind of like this cool underground community where there's essentially a forum, a web forum, a website that's maintained by its users. You do have to post, you know, your GPS track, and you have to say, like, I'm going to attempt this race. But unless you kind of bring the press to you in general, like, I finished in the main plaza at the base of Machu Picchu, and there were just, like, tourists there taking their pictures, like, what's going on? So it's kind of funny.
Well, you mentioned the tourists, but when you were running along the way, this is such a sacred, incredible place. Were you thinking of Incans?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I definitely channel the Chaskis. The Chaskis were the Incan runner messengers. So the Incans had this incredible network of relay runners, essentially, so they could send out messages in all directions, and they'd send out these runners on all the different trails to all the different cities. And so there's a lot of running in Peru's history and culture, and I really try to channel that when I'm there, and I try to learn and be inspired by the incredibly fit people that I see down there, the indigenous Peruvians. And I do think that I got a little bit of love from those guys. There were definitely moments where I was passing Not so much the tourists. The tourists mostly just looked confused. A couple people asked me if I was all right. But the Peruvians, I think a few of them had heard that I was doing this attempt because I have a bunch of Peruvian friends who had told other guides and stuff. And so there were definitely some teams of the indigenous people who gave me a big whoop as I went by. So that was really exciting to kind of know, okay, these guys, they kind of get what's going on here.
That's runner Tyler Andrews, who just posted the fastest known time ever on the Salkantay Trail from Soraypampa, Peru to Machu Picchu. Tyler, thanks so much, and good luck at the 50K World Championships in Bucharest. You're doing that in September, and then the Olympic Trials. Best of luck to you.
Thank you so much.
Okay, now let's go back to school. Do you think that should be in July or after Labor Day? Back in the 1800s, kids went year-round, except when they took time off to harvest. But by the late 1800s, concern about the ill effects of too much school led to a no-summer school year. It wasn't until the 1990s that schools began to start in the summer, largely in southern states, for air conditioning. There is a year-round education movement to try to improve test scores, but USA Today reports that in studies, say in California, it doesn't work. So why else would schools open in the summer? Felissa Kramer is with Chalkbeat, a nonprofit that covers education. Felissa, is improved test scores, is that the main reason?
That's kind of one small piece of the puzzle. Bigger pieces are really some of these other trends that we've seen in education. So dual enrollment turns out to be a big deal. More high school students are taking college courses while they're in high school. And in order to make those schedules line up, schools need to start earlier. There's also the athletic issue. So, you know, in order to have a whole athletic season, students would have to go back to practice weeks before classes open. So a lot of the places that are starting earlier are ones that have a very strong athletics culture as well. But two other factors that often lead to districts starting their schools after Labor Day, one is union contracts. So, you know, in New York City, for example, the union contract says school can't start until a few days after so teachers can get set up. In Newark, next year, school won't begin until after Labor Day. And then the other big dynamic here is tourism. So there are a handful of states that have laws on the book saying you cannot begin school until after Labor Day. And all those states have waiver processes for districts that want to start earlier. Those laws were really pushed by the tourism industry. Michigan is one of them. You know, the Upper Peninsula, like, really counts on August to shore up the budget for the rest of the year. If families in the rest of the state and nearby states didn't come to the Upper Peninsula at the end of August, that would be a huge hit to the local economy.
But what about other things that people are trying? There's four-day school weeks, the hopes there to save money, maybe, and give teachers and students more special time, let's say, on a Friday. Other schools are trying multitracking, but that's hell on parents, you know, if you've got one kid in, let's say, a morning session and another in an afternoon.
So I think you're really hitting the nail on the head there about parents, that schedules are, they seem attractive to play with, but these things really, really matter to parents, right? So year-round schools, that was a hot topic in the 90s. It's somewhat fallen out of favor, in part because that's just really complicated for families. The four-day weeks, they're not intended to boost scores. They're really intended to keep struggling, cash-strapped districts afloat. That's challenging for families, and we are starting to see some evidence that it's bad for kids learning as well. And then, yeah, multi-track. I mean, I don't think we cover any districts where that happens. But as a parent, I can say, like, no thank you.
No, thank you.
It's hard enough coordinating a schedule. I do understand.
Yeah. Well, some of the backers of starting school early say it allows kids to complete work before the December holiday break. It allows for more breaks, which takes away from how many days in school there are. But you could have a fall break in September or October, a winter break in February. Where do you think this is going? Like, from what you're seeing, are more schools going to start earlier or not?
I mean, I think climate really is a piece of this. You know, the districts that we cover in the north is that it would be useful to start our schedule a little bit earlier because we'd like to build in snow days because our winters are much less predictable than they have been.
Well, that's fascinating. Climate change impacting school days. That's Phyllisa Kramer, managing editor of Chalkbeat, the nonprofit news organization that covers education. Phyllisa, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Remember that court case about music copyright when a jury found that the Robin Thicke song Blurred Lines had infringed on the copyright from Marvin Gaye's Got to Give It Up? Well, there was a similar jury decision last month in California. They found that the writers of the Katy Perry hit Dark Horse had copied a part of a song by the Christian hip-hop artist Flame. Here is a bit of the Katy Perry song.
Mark my word, just never make you levitate.
And here's a bit of the song Joyful Noise by Flame.
I heard a lot of words that have tickled many ears. That's why I praise God for the word that we adhere. The word became flesh.
Flame was awarded $2.8 million in damages, and musician and YouTuber Adam Neely says that sets a dangerous precedent. Hi, Adam.
Hey, how's it going?
It's going well. And by the way, when we say YouTuber, you've got a YouTube channel with hundreds of thousands of followers. So maybe I should call you YouTube sensation, Adam Neely. But listen, you say that this case was unfairly decided. And I want to start with what the jury found. They found that a part of Dark Horse was stolen from Joyful Noise. And you have prepared for us some music samples that we can listen to with the lyrics stripped out so it's easier for people to hear the difference. This is Dark Horse. Okay, and then this is your demonstration of the bit of music from Joyful Noise. They sound pretty similar.
They do, and I intentionally made them sound as similar as possible. They're using the same kinds of instruments, the same kinds of synthesizers. They're also transposed to the same key, and they're also transposed to the same tempo, which isn't the case in the normal recordings. I did that specifically to show what the jury, I think, was shown. And, you know, from my perspective, that is kind of disingenuous because these two what are called ostinatos are such a small part of both songs.
What do you mean?
Well, in the Katy Perry song, Dark Horse, you only hear that during the verse. It's not the melody of the song. It's not the chord progression of the song. It's not the drum groove of the song. It's only a very small portion of the entire composition, whereas in the Flame song, Joyful Noise, it occurs throughout the entire composition. Mm-hmm. And also, Joyful Noise has a different chord progression that has nothing to do with the Katy Perry song.
But isn't the fact that each has that same melody in there enough to constitute a copyright infringement as the jury found?
Well, I'm not a lawyer. I'm just a music YouTuber. But as far as I understand, there's something called striking similarity that needs to be proven in a copyright case. And in this case, the jury found that there was a striking similarity between the two pieces of music. Now, the problem from my perspective is that you could find that same striking similarity between any number of different kinds of music, any number of different pieces of music throughout history. It's such a small little melodic fragment that, mm-hmm. you know, I don't feel like it is unique to Joyful Noise. And I feel like if you broadly applied this decision to every piece of music, we just would be in this morass of copyright infringement laws.
Now, to make your point, you decided to take a couple of other pieces of music that people know very well and do them with this synthesizer to show how similar they could be to Joyful Noise. Let's take a listen here. The first one is actually Bach, but take a listen. Now, explain what that is. Why does it sound just like what we just heard a moment ago?
Well, it's the beginning phrase of the adagio from Bach's Violin Sonata in F minor. And it's a similar sort of repeated staccato quarter note kind of pattern in a minor key that starts on the third degree of the minor scale and then descends in exactly the same way that Joyful Noise does. So if you just use the same synthesizer, it's going to sound exactly the same as Joyful Noise.
Mm-hmm. And here is a popular Christmas song. Which one is this?
This is Jolly Old Saint Nicholas.
Okay, listen to this. Doesn't sound like Jolly Old Saint Nicholas, but I guess it is.
No, and if you put it in that context, the context of having kind of a minor key drum groove, it's going to sound very similar.
So Katy Perry's record company has been ordered to pay the artist Flame $2.8 million, as we said. What do you think is the larger implication of this decision?
Well, it's hard to say, but I can definitely speak for myself as a musician and other musicians that I know. We're pretty scared with this decision, to be honest, because it's hard to say what is being taken from what in music. We have this kind of shared musical language. We use the same notes. We use the same chord progressions. We use the same kinds of drum grooves, same kinds of sounds, and we're all inspired by each other. And this decision seems to say that we can own a very specific, minute, somebody can own a very specific, minute part of the shared musical language. And so we don't really know what's going to happen. Are we going to start getting sued for just using very similar, I don't know, chord progressions, similar drums, similar other ostinatos? It's hard to really say, but I think it sets a dangerous precedent to say that you can own such a small and minute piece of music in such a granular way.
That is musician Adam Neely. Adam, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
And can you guess which song this is? This is the Katy Perry version.
That I know.
Not Bach or the Christmas song. Here Now is a production of NPR and WVUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here Now. Play with magic.